Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America, tells the inside story of Guatemalan teens forced to work against their will on a massive chicken and egg farm in Ohio. They say chicken manure falls in your eyes burn, your clothes get dirty, there are lots of dead chickens, they reek and they're rotting. That's how hard the job is. That is how Guatemalan teenagers describe a typical day at Trillium Farms in Marion County, Ohio. They work up to 16-hour days, make about $600 a week. $550 goes to the smuggler who brought them to the United States. They live with seven other people in a three-bedroom trailer with no running water and no toilet. A federal investigation is ongoing, according to this documentary. Trillium Farms has not been charged with wrongdoing and has denied any knowledge of trafficked teens working at their plants. Joining us to talk about this incredible reporting today is Andres Sedial. He and Daffodil Alton co-produced, wrote, and directed the new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. Andres is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and professor of visual journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He has produced the films Rape in the Fields and Rape on the Night Shift, which exposed rampant sexual assault of immigrant women in the agricultural and janitorial industries. We have done several shows about these documentaries, and you can find those at yourcallradio.org. And Andres Sedial joins me here in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is an amazing documentary. Before we talk about this, as we always do on our media roundtable, we like to highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what did you see that caught your attention this week?
What caught my attention was pieces that were done by several media outlets, but I'll just highlight a former colleague, Nick Muroff, writing for the Washington Post, talking about the decision that the Department of Homeland Security is looking into in terms of housing unaccompanied minors on military bases. Mm-hmm. This is following an announcement by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that they are going to start separating parents from children who are coming. So this is a policy that as Trump points out, was a law that was enacted under a Democratic administration, but now he's putting into effect and actually blaming the Democrats for saying, you made us now separate parents from their children. So these are people who are coming, fleeing violence from Central America, a lot of them seeking asylum, arriving at the border, and then the government saying, okay, we're going to prosecute these parents criminally, so we're going to take them and put them in some sort of detention, and then the minors can't go to detention, so we're going to house them somewhere else. Health and Human Services, which is the federal agency in charge of housing the children, doesn't have enough room, so now they're looking to house these children on military bases.
Wow. There have been a lot of stories about children that have already been separated from their parents, and in many cases, their parents can't find them.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, and this, the reason why this stood out to me is because this goes to the heart of the story that we were telling in our piece, Trafficked in America. But not only are there children who are coming here unaccompanied, and this is anything from toddlers to 17-year-olds who come here looking for work, fleeing violence. They've been threatened against their lives, and they're here alone. But there's other people who get separated from their parents and then they just can't find them. So this is something that's happening. This isn't a few children. This is hundreds of thousands of children.
There are many, many layers to immigration. What do you think specifically about how the media are covering the children who have been trafficked?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons why we took on this subject is because, in general, there hasn't been a lot of coverage about trafficking, specifically labor trafficking. When you hear human trafficking, most of the coverage that you see has to do with sex trafficking, which is forcing somebody to work in the sex trade. And this is something that is, if you look at federal prosecutions, if you look at what's covered in the media, well over 90% of cases that are prosecuted of human trafficking are sex trafficking cases. Right. What you see in the media is mostly sex trafficking cases. And there's lots of reasons for this. But based on global numbers that we have, labor trafficking is a much bigger problem. And it's most likely a bigger problem in this country as well. but we don't see it and we don't hear about it and the cases aren't prosecuted. One of the main reasons for this is because sex trafficking, which is actually just a form of labor trafficking in which the labor that is being done is sex work, is illegal on its face. So if you see a young person on the street doing sex work, you know there's a problem. You can pick them up, you can prosecute them, you can look into them, investigate if they're a victim of human trafficking, you can prosecute the pimp. But all the other forms of labor trafficking that we see, the work itself is not necessarily illegal. So, for instance, if you're a janitor, some of the janitors on Rape on the Night Shift were being trafficked. Janitorial work is not illegal. So if you see somebody with a mop cleaning an office, you don't necessarily know anything's wrong. You know, if you see somebody, picking tomatoes in a field, well, that work is legal. So you don't know if that person is being trafficked or not. Mm. So it's much more difficult to investigate that. It's much more difficult to prosecute that. And as reporters, it's much more difficult to tell that story. Mm. So that was an underreported story that led us to wanting to tell this story about these unaccompanied minors who came here from Central America and ended up being labor trafficked.
And another question before we dive in and talk about this incredible documentary, Trafficked in America. On Wednesday morning, during a discussion about sanctuary laws with California politicians, this happened in D.C., Donald Trump referred to people who are trying to enter the country as animals. What are your thoughts about how this kind of very racist rhetoric has changed the depiction of undocumented immigrants in the media and in the public discourse?
Well, it's very disconcerting, to say the least, when the President of the United States is referring to people as animals. This, of course, there's a long history of dehumanizing other people as a precursor to all kinds of racist policies, including genocide. So it's a very disturbing development. Of course, when this first came across, you know, my feed earlier this week, part of my mind said, "Okay, was this a recycled campaign rhetoric when he was saying that Mexico's not sending their best people; they're sending the rapists and the criminals." I felt like this was recycled news, and then when I realized he was saying it now, it was really shocking to hear that this is still the rhetoric he's using as the President of the United States. So, why he's doing it he seems to be. More interested in spreading fear than actual information about what's going on with our immigration policy. I mean, there's lots of things to point to in terms of where we're at right now. People coming to this country has gone down. Deportations are down. Things over a longer period of time. So, for instance, deportations have gone up, and ICE enforcement has gone up since Trump has taken office. But those numbers are down from when the height of the Obama administration. Mm. That's something that we haven't talked a lot about is Obama at one point was called the deporter in chief. That's when these enforcements were at an all-time high. Those have steadily gone down. Now that Trump's in office, they're slowly picking back up again.
Mm. And the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House, you know, some Trump supporters have said that they now feel more comfortable talking about how they feel about immigrants. And we're seeing this play out on the streets. In Manhattan recently, we saw this lawyer who was yelling at people for speaking Spanish. Mm. I mean, people are feeling threatened just walking down the street because of these incidents that keep happening.
Well, and for good reason. I mean, the other thing about these ICE enforcements is that, you know, we see ICE enforcements happening. We've seen them in front of schools. We've seen them very disturbingly at courthouses. So there's been incidents in which a woman has accused her partner of domestic violence and then goes to court. And then he tips off ICE that she doesn't have papers, and they go to the actual courthouse to pick her up. I mean, that's a very extreme situation because it breaks down an immigrant's ability to trust in the rule of law, that the law will protect them. One of the things that we saw when we were doing our reporting about sexual assault in agricultural and the janitorial industries is that people didn't realize that whether you have an immigration status that allows you to be here and work, the laws of this country still apply to you. So if you're a victim of violence, the police still protect you. But because there's a breakdown in trust now, people aren't going to the police. And that's why there's a lot of local law enforcement agencies, and that's the one of the main reasons behind these sanctuary cities is because local law enforcement still wants to have the trust with the people in their community so that they'll come forward and report crimes. But if people are afraid to do that, they're afraid to go to the courthouse, if they're afraid to drop off their kids at school, then there's a major problem happening at a root level in our society. Mm-hmm.
Andres Sediel is co-producer. He wrote and directed the new Frontline documentary Trafficked in America, which focuses on Guatemalan teenagers who are forced to work against their will on American farms. In this case, it's a massive chicken and egg farm in Ohio. And the companies that profit from forced labor and the U.S. government's role in delivering the teens to their traffickers are exposed in this documentary. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. You can also watch the hour documentary online. The documentary is amazing because you not only do you expose this, but you go to Guatemala, you interview a family whose 14-year-old son is trafficked to the United States. You also interview an executive of Trillium Farms who's never spoken to the media before. First off, how did you come across this story? Why did you want to specifically focus on this angle?
Well, when we finished Rape on the Night Shift and we were looking at the abuse of janitorial workers, we had come across a case in which some workers were being trafficked and they were being forced to work against their will. There was sexual violence being used against them to coerce them to work these long hours and have their pay taken away. And that was our first introduction to this concept of labor trafficking. And so we began to explore that and said, well, what is labor trafficking? As we looked around and tried to find other media reports and other cases, and there wasn't a lot out there, we started surveying different cases. There was some huge cases. There was some post-Katrina cases where some South Indian men were being forced to work in fixing the shipyards. There was also cases in agriculture. And we got a press release about some traffickers who had just been sentenced in Ohio in this case. And so when we looked at this case, and I had experience looking into the egg industry in prior reporting, and so I was familiar with the landscape, there was this idea that the added element of the unaccompanied minors became something that we wanted to look into. And then there was one more twist that made it much more complicated for us and revealing in terms of how our immigration system is in total shambles right now, is that these kids had come as unaccompanied minors, were taken into custody by Health and Human Services, who then turned around and released them to their traffickers who were posing as sponsors. They basically said to the government, hey, we'll take care of these kids while they're waiting for their court date. And the government hands them right back to their traffickers. So the government was complicit in this case, and it made us wonder how common this was.
That was one of the more shocking elements of the documentary. So this was happening under the Obama administration when so many children were crossing the border, taking these horrific journeys here. I mean, the journey itself is horrific. They have to deal with sexual assault, rape. They have to deal with rattlesnakes in the desert. Are they going to have enough water? I mean, as a child, you can't even imagine what that's like. And then when they get to the border, according to your documentary, HHS was so overwhelmed that they dropped the ball. They're supposed to do background checks. They're supposed to take fingerprints before they give a child to an adult, and they didn't do any of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where this was a particular time which was being referred to as a surge, which an unprecedented number of unaccompanied minors were coming to this country. And the federal agency that was in charge, HHS, was simply overwhelmed. They didn't have enough facilities to house the children. And so it's where a particular or a good intent goes wrong. One of the things that the government doesn't want to do is they don't want to put these kids in detention. They don't want to put them in a jail situation. So they want to release them to a family member, to an uncle, to a friend, somebody who can take care of them so that the kids can be going to school as their asylum proceedings are moving forward. So in this effort to move them out and get them out of their custody, they started relaxing all their vetting processes. And it was the traffickers were aware of this. They understood that this was happening. So in this little tiny village in Guatemala, the trafficker who had been smuggling people back and forth for years realized that there was an opportunity to bring teenagers. And he went around and talked to the different family members. Some of them were extended relatives. This is a very small small town, and said, hey, this is the time. If your kid wants to go, let's go now. Mm. And was able to entice them that way.
And going back to HHS just briefly, according to your reporting, no one wanted to take responsibility for handing these children over to an adult with no background check. And the HHS division responsible for placing the teens declined to be interviewed.
They declined to go on camera, and they had been the Senator Portman from Ohio. This happened in the state of Ohio. Had held hearings in which they, talked to HHS, who basically denied that this was their responsibility, saying that once they handed them over to the sponsors, it's the sponsors' responsibility to take care of them. They didn't have a mechanism in place to check back up on the kids to see what was going on. In that. 2 years later, just a few days after our documentary came out, they had another hearing because Senator Portman wasn't convinced that they had done anything new to reform or to change anything. One of the pieces of information that came out during that hearing was that HHS had made an attempt to go and try to track down some of the kids that they had released. Mm-hmm. And in a three-month period, they made phone calls in which they found, well, some are in school, some are working, some are doing this. But there was approximately 20% of the kids that they could not find at all. They had no idea what had happened to these kids. Now, this was a small sample, but when we're talking about, these were kids who hadn't shown up for their court dates. So when you talk about approximately 100,000 kids who haven't shown up to their court dates, because about half of them don't show up, of the 180,000 that have come in the last 3 years, 20% of those, if that number holds true, would mean there's about 20,000 missing kids. Wow. That we don't know where they are. Now, this case of trafficking in Ohio was one case that we found. Other colleagues like Grants Burke at the Associated Press have found others. And we have to assume that if these kids are coming here to work, they're vulnerable, they're by themselves, and we don't know where they are, that others are vulnerable to being trafficked as well.
Hmm. Today we're joined by Andres Sediel, co-producer, writer, and director of the Frontline documentary Trafficked in America, which focuses on Guatemalan teens who are forced to work against their will on American farms. We're talking about slaughterhouses. In this particular case, teens were working in a massive chicken and egg farm in Ohio. And if you have any questions or comments for Andres about this documentary and the reporting he and his incredible team did, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email your call at kalw.org. Head over to KALW's Facebook page, click on the live video, and you can leave a comment there. Let's talk about some of the teens who end up in many cases, Middle America, working in these slaughterhouses. Now, there has been some amazing reporting about the violence in places like Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and gangs that are threatening children. The parents feel that they have no other choice than to send their kids north. In the case of some of the teens that you connected with, they are from western islands of Guatemala who are very, very poor. You met Alberto and Erlinda, the parents of a 14-year-old boy who tended sugarcane for $1 a day. And in 2014, a neighbor in the village, as you said, basically made them an offer. The family could send their son to the United States for $15,000 in return for jobs and a chance to go to school.
That's exactly right. And it's the kind of situation where you can understand why somebody might make that deal. I mean, this is a place where in the western highlands of Guatemala where, you know, they don't have running water. They barely have electricity. They're living off the land. There's not a lot of opportunity. There's not a lot of opportunity for education. And the people who have come to the United States and made some money and sent the money back home, those people have done better. So this is an opportunity for in this case, you know, hardworking families. I mean, these are boys who grew up working, doing manual labor as work, coming to make some money to help their families. Now, what happened in this case was that you know, anytime somebody comes to this country, basically in every situation, it costs money to get here. You have to pay a smuggler, you have to pay coyotes to get you along the way. And actually, the harder it is to get into the country, the bigger the wall is, the more border agents there are, the more expensive it becomes. It's not, people are going to keep coming. It's just going to take more money. Mm. It's more bribing, more digging tunnels, all those kinds of things. Now, so the normal cost to get here might be about $7,000. Now, and people might pay half of that up front. Now, these people didn't have a dime to their name to pay up front. So what the deal was okay, we'll pay, you don't have any money up front, but I'm going to charge you $15,000 and you're going to pay it back over time. So that was the deal that they went into. And as collateral, they gave up the deeds to their homes, saying that if once you pay this back, we'll give you your deed back. And so when the kids got here, all of a sudden they were put in a trailer with, this is in the middle of Ohio, with no heat, no air conditioning, no running water. They were being forced to pay the trafficker for food, transportation to and from work. And at the end, they were basically having all their wages taken by the trafficker themselves. And they were being stuffed in this trailer where, you know, it might be 8 or 10 of them in a trailer. They were literally, there was a trap door. We visited one of these trailers in the kitchen that would go down to the ground where there was beds and mattresses set up on the ground underneath the trailer, and kids were living there as well. Mm. So it's just these horrific conditions where they're being exploited in every way possible.
The footage of the trailer was just horrific. There's cockroaches. There's no toilet in some cases. Mm. I mean, this has to be shocking for these children. Not only do they not know where they're going, all of a sudden they're, here's where you're sleeping with these strangers, and then you have to go work in this chicken farm 16 hours a day?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing is, you know, some people, and there was a former executive of another country who had been treating his workers in a similar way, who had made comments to the effect of, well, it's better than where they came from, oh. Right? Which is you know, we asked that to some of the workers. Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think? I mean, these are people who grew up with a dirt floor home, and they were completely shocked by these conditions because this was not what they were expecting. They weren't able to wash their clothes, for instance. It was very some of them had been promised or enticed with, well, the job that you're going to get is going to be a nice job, and you're going to wear a suit and a tie, and you're going to go work in an office building. And after this harrowing journey, the first thing that they do is they drive them to the chicken plant and put them in these conditions, which are difficult conditions to work in. This is it gets very hot in the chicken houses. As you mentioned at the top, there's a lot of manure and dust and feathers, and it's very difficult work. It's manual labor. They were doing vaccinating of chickens. They were de-beaking chickens. They were disposing and killing and gassing old chickens for 12, 14, 16 hours a day. So one of the workers who – he wasn't a miner, but he had been trafficked by the same trafficker in the same conditions. He said that when he came here full of hope, and then when he found out what was going on, he would just break down and cry. Mm.
Today we're joined by Andres Sediel, co-producer, writer, and director of the new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. It focuses on Guatemalan teenagers who are forced to work against their will on American farms, in this case, a massive chicken and egg farm in Ohio. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
Here on KALW San Francisco, where we are in the final day of our membership campaign asking for your support, I'm Matt Martin, and usually Malia Hayraz is on, producer of Your Call, would be here with me asking alongside me. But right now she's trying to get a hold of a reporter in Gaza. That is the kind of work that you support in the moment, trying to give you up-to-date reporting, trying to give you real journalism, independent voices. That's what you support when you call 800 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. It is the last day of our May campaign. We are pushing toward our goal, and in this hour of your call, we have a big challenge, and that is to get 50 people to support local public radio before 1A begins. If we do that, it will mean an additional $1,000 will come from a couple of great listeners, Kevin Persklove in San Francisco and Elizabeth Hartka in Oakland. To do this, we're keeping the break short, so we need it to start now. 800-525-9917 is the number to call. Support independent journalism. Support the Media Roundtable. Your call, KALW as a whole. All the reporting, information, ideas, music that you hear here. KALW.org is another way to do it. Just click that donate button here on this final day of the campaign. Show your support. KALW.org, 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thanks to David Romano in San Francisco, Wendy Birch Steele in Oakland. They gave their support to KALW just a few minutes ago at our website. Thanks also to Hartmut Gerdes in San Francisco, Howard Lasser in Oakland. People around the Bay Area showing their support for this kind of journalism. If you tune into the Media Roundtable, you know you will learn something. You'll hear from committed journalists. You'll hear Rose and her guests talk about how the news is covered and sometimes miscovered. Your support keeps that coming. KALW.org or 800-525-9917. Thank you.
This is your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Andres Sediel. He's co-producer, writer, and director of the new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. It exposes the story about Guatemalan teens who are forced to work against their will on an egg farm in Ohio. And I misspoke earlier. It's not really a chicken and egg farm. The chickens are there to lay eggs. 10 million eggs a day, is that right?
Yeah, this is one company, yeah.
Wow, 10 million eggs a day. And this is an incredible documentary. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and the full documentary is available online. Let's talk a little bit about this massive company, Trillium Farms. Before it was Trillium, it was owned and operated by one of the country's biggest and most notorious egg producers. His name is Jack DeCoster. And in 97, he was fined $2 million for violations at his facilities in Maine. For years, he was fined for abuses against his workers.
Yeah, Jack DeCoster was very well known for several major infractions, including one of the largest salmonella outbreaks in U.S. history back in 2010, which the CDC estimated sickened as many as 56,000 people. Jack DeCoster got started as a small-time egg producer in Maine and quickly became one of the biggest egg producers in the country. And one of the ways he did this was basically a complete disregard for many violations of everything from environmental to labor to health. And he was fined repeatedly over the years. He moved operations into Iowa and Ohio. He was eventually kicked out of Iowa for being a serial violator. And then after the 2010 salmonella outbreak, he basically sold all of his businesses and just began leasing his facilities to other companies. So Trillium Farms, which was the company where the teenagers were working while they were being trafficked, was one of the companies that took over Jack DeCoster's former facilities.
In that salmonella outbreak, sickened 56,000 people. That was a massive outbreak.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest ones in U.S. history.
You spoke to a number of people. Pablo Duran Sr., for example, he had a multi-million-dollar contract with Trillium to supply workers. You were able to get one egg executive on the record, but all of these people just sort of said, oh, we just didn't know about these young people working in these horrific conditions. We had no idea. How is that possible?
Well, that's one of the things that happens. It's kind of the way that the U.S. economy has been going in terms of once upon a time, people used to be employees for companies. And slowly, all work is being contracted out. Mm-hmm. So what happened in this case is that Trillium, which was the main company, hires a contractor, Pablo Duran Sr., who used to be a contractor for Jack DeCoster. Dudan then employs subcontractors to do the work. And so what it creates is a layers of deniability at every level, so that Dudan can say, well, I don't know what was happening. Those were my subcontractors. And Trillium can say, well, I don't know what was happening. That was my contractor. And so what it does is they become insulated in many ways from legal action if they don't know. Now, there's this concept of willful blindness. And in fact, Jack DeCoster was eventually sent to prison for the Salmonella outbreak, even though the government couldn't prove that he knew that the eggs were tainted. But he was able to serve prison time because the federal government decided that he should have known, right? So this is some ways that people are taking action against these layers of deniability. But it's the more people we talked to, it was trying to figure out, okay, you have teenage kids working at your farm. How could you not see that? Mm. And some people would say, oh, well, they don't look like kids because, you know, they're doing hard work, or they have overalls on and a mask, or I guess what Trillium said was they don't supervise the work. They supervise that the work gets done. So in the same way that, for instance, if you want to have a leak fixed in your house or fix your roof, you hire a contractor to come do it. You're not supervising how they do the work. You just want them to get the work done. That was what Trillium's response was.
What about labor laws? Because these teens said that they worked 16-hour days. Sometimes they only got a five-minute break. And if they were lucky, they made $600 a week.
Yeah, well, so that's the other thing, is that these labor laws differ from state to state in terms of child labor. So in some states, if you're 16 years old, for instance, and you're working in agriculture, then you can work just like an adult would work. In other states, there's lower if you're 14, that there's more restrictions. You can't be doing hazardous work, these types of things. They weren't necessarily they were obviously being exploited. But again, these weren't Trillium employees. Huh. These were people who were working for the contracting company.
So the system is allowing these companies to say, sorry, we just didn't know.
That's exactly what's happening. And it's also happening in terms of immigration, in terms of, well, those aren't whether or not they're documented or not. Well, I didn't hire them. I hired a contractor who told me that they were legal. So these layers of deniability are happening on several levels.
You were able to convince John Glessner, former CEO of Ohio Fresh Eggs and a former associate of DeCoster, to talk with you. And he says that one of the biggest issues is finding people to do the work. Quote, to get the work done, they turn to immigrants, even though he suspected some of them had false documents. So, I mean, again, many layers to this. What does this say about the fact that these immigrants, these teenagers from Guatemala, are trafficked here illegally, totally exploited by some of the most powerful agribusinesses in the United States? And yet what we hear from this White House and so many Republicans is just victim blaming.
It's incredible because one of the things, you know, as the reporting that I've been doing on the agricultural industry is, you know, pretty much I would say the vast majority of the owners of these agribusinesses are Republican. At the same time, when you talk to them, a lot of them are in favor of immigration reform. Their voices aren't being heard. They're not speaking out loud enough, but they are feeling the effects of ISIS coming in and raiding their plants. There was a huge raid on a slaughterhouse in Tennessee a month ago. It was the largest single site immigration raid since the raid at Postville in Iowa 10 years ago, which caused mass chaos in this village and displaced lots of families and tore families apart. It was a policy that the Obama administration decided no longer to do because it was so disruptive. The Trump administration has now done it again in Tennessee. And this is a case where in the case in Tennessee, about, I think, 100 people were detained. But then something like 700 kids didn't show up to school the next day because people were so afraid. So these types of immigration raids are extremely disruptive to families, communities, and then to the businesses. Mm. The business doesn't want to be raided. They want workers. They want workers with papers. They want workers who are being treated well. So in some ways, they just want this problem to go away because they can't find American workers who are going to do this work. They are reliant on immigrant labor. And by extension, so are we. If we want cheap eggs, if we want cheap bacon, if we want any of cheap tomatoes, we are relying as a society on this cheap immigrant labor. Mm. So it's really all of a problem.
It's so very true. But if these companies want immigration reform, in the meantime, can't they at least treat these people with a little bit of dignity, pay them a living wage, and ensure that they're not in a three-bedroom trailer with no running water and no toilet?
Yeah, my hope is that in most cases they are, and that these are the exception. And we focus on this case, which is obviously an egregious case. These trailers were not owned by the company. They are saying this was somebody else's, but we weren't paying attention to what was going on. So it's really about raising awareness about the conditions for workers, how they're living, how they're being treated across the industry. Because, again, the more I talk to people who work in the agricultural industry, they want workers to be happy. They want workers to have nice homes and come back to work the next day. Because the flip side is that when workers aren't getting paid well and they're working in bad conditions, it's hard to keep them because they'll move on. Because they're getting burnt out. They're looking for another wage. And it causes a lot of disruption in the labor force. So there's got to be a solution where everybody's getting treated better that works for everyone.
Have you had any response from politicians to this documentary?
Not yet. It's been out for a couple weeks. There was the Senate hearing that happened a couple days after our piece. That was scheduled, so that wasn't in a direct response. But we know that these issues are being talked about. We know that this is something that people in Washington are paying attention to. Hmm.
What kind of response have you received?
So far, it's been very positive in terms of people saying the kinds of things of we had no idea, this was very eye-opening, which is one of the reasons why we did this, was to raise this type of awareness. One of the things that we've focused on very specifically in this case was trying to put together all the pieces of this the scheme. So everyone from the family in Guatemala to the trafficker who brought them here, to the contractor, Pablo Dudan, who was recently arrested in federal custody, all the way up to the company itself. So we're really trying to paint a picture to show how this isn't just one bad guy and in one bad situation, but it's more of a systemic problem.
What kind of emotional scars does this experience leave on these young teenagers from places like Guatemala?
Oh, I mean, it's hard. You can only imagine. I mean, these are kids. So, this would be tough for anybody. But this kind of childhood trauma you mentioned before, the trip up here being traumatizing in and of itself, the uncertainty, the being living in these horrible conditions. What ended up happening was one of the teens who, despite threats to him and to his family, if he were to speak out, was able to call an uncle in Florida and was pleading for him to help. The uncle was then able to contact local law enforcement, who then got in touch with the federal officials, which ultimately led to a raid and a rescue of the kids. Now, from the family's perspective back in Guatemala, for some of these kids, when this raid happened, they didn't know what was going on. All they knew is that the federal officials came and took everybody, and they were scared and they were frightened, and they thought, oh no, what's going to happen to my child? They're going to go into detention. He's not going to be able to work. He won't be able to send me money. So there was a lot of confusion, a lot of misinformation. Ultimately, the children were placed into federal foster care, and based on our reporting, it sounds like most, if not all of them, have received visas for victims of trafficking and are now in school or working here.
In the United States.
Yes.
When they get here and they're sent to Ohio with strangers, are they able to call their parents to say, Mom, I made it?
It didn't sound like it was hard to find out, and every kid was different, but they, for the most part, did not even have access to cell phones. So the teen that was able to call his uncle in Florida was able to get a hold of a phone somehow and reach out. And it was in a time where, very desperately in secret making the phone call. So the trafficker, who was very close by at all times, wouldn't know that this was happening. One of the things that the kid didn't even know where he was. So this was a situation that once the federal officials started investigating, And where are you? He's like, I don't know. And they're out in the middle of rural Ohio with very few landmarks, and he had to start to describe and take pictures of street signs and things like that so they could even begin to locate where they were.
Right, because these are kids from a village in Guatemala who've never left. This is their first time out of their home, out of their home area.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
They had basically never left this little village in Guatemala, and then they've traveled across Mexico. They were then flown from where they were being held in detention to Ohio, getting on a plane, and the traffickers pick them up and drive them out into the middle of nowhere. They don't know where they are. They don't have a map. They don't have their GPS. They don't know where they are.
Andres Sediel is co-producer, writer, and director of the new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America, which focuses on Guatemalan teens who are forced to work against their will on an egg farm in Ohio. We briefly touched on this earlier. More than 180,000 minors have been placed in various communities. Do we have any idea how many today are probably working in slaughterhouses as we are talking about this issue?
We don't have numbers about that specifically, but based on our reporting, when we went back to Iowa, where Jack DeCoster had been operating and Pablo Duran, the trafficker in this case, had gotten started, we were doing some reporting there, and we started to hear stories about more teens working in food processing plants. So we started looking around. And sure enough, we met and talked to several teens, as well as several other sources confirming that in this one small town in the middle of Iowa, there were at least 30 teens who had been working at a slaughterhouse there. So that was just scratching the surface. I mean, what happens is any of these teens, so if you imagine 180,000 unaccompanied minors coming over the last couple of years, they all come here with some level of debt. As I mentioned before, you don't get here for free. So they may be fleeing violence. They may have very legitimate asylum claims, but they still have to pay money back. So then they're going to go work. And where are they going to work? Who's going to take them? Mm-hmm. And if you end up in rural America, the jobs that are available for undocumented immigrants tend to be in food processing.
As you said, a lot of people are demanding cheap food, and it is very cheap in many cases. Not here, not when you're talking organic, but if you go to some of the big box stores, it's cheap. What can people do about this? I'm sure that people listening are shocked. Maybe they didn't know about this. What can they do?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the things is to beyond the raising the awareness and looking into where this is coming from, it's not so simple to just say, well, I'm not going to buy those cheap goods, because, you know, maybe here in the Bay Area, you do have access, and you go to yourself and you say, okay, I'm going to go look at Safeway, and there's going to be a dozen eggs for $3.99, or there's the pasture-raised eggs for $8.99. Okay, well, okay, I'll get the good pasture ones because I hope that they're better. But even if you have the means to do that, because you're here in the Bay Area, you have access to that. There's lots of places in the United States where you simply don't have access to that. So when you're in the Midwest, in the places where we were, we're talking about 89 cents for a dozen eggs.
Wow.
But that's the only eggs that are there. And you might have to drive 15, 20 miles to get to the Walmart to buy them. So there is there's things that those of us who have access and means can do, but there's other people who are just trying to get by, and that's all that is available to them.
What is next for this project? Rape in the Fields and Rape on the Night Shift had incredible impact. We did shows about it. Laws were changed. Women were empowered. I mean, the power of a documentary at a time when there's so much going on and we cannot keep up with what's happening. When you sit down and you watch this hour or 2 hour documentary, it really does have an impact.
So one of the things this is an ongoing case that it was one of the challenges of the case. It's one of the reasons why it took us 2 years to do, was because when we started this documentary, Pablo Duran, the contractor in the middle of this scheme, was in Mexico, and he was out of reach of the federal authorities. We were able to get an interview with him while he was in Mexico, and he's since been apprehended and imprisoned. So this case continues. The federal government is still investigating, and they're not done. So as long as the case goes on, we're going to be paying attention.
Andres Sediel is co-producer, writer, and director of the new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America, which focuses on Guatemalan teenagers who are forced to work against their will on an egg farm in Ohio. And you can see the full documentary online now. Andres is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and professor of visual journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He also produced the films Rape in the Fields and Rape on the Night Shift. Andres, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for your work.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to switch gears and talk about media coverage of the deadly protests in Gaza. Today we are joined by Shireen Tadros, head of the UN office in New York for Amnesty International. Shireen is an award-winning journalist. She was Middle East correspondent for Sky News and Al Jazeera English, one of two foreign correspondents inside Gaza during the Israeli war on the Strip in 2008 and 9. Hi, Shireen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on Monday, Israeli military forces shot and killed 59 Palestinians, injured more than 1,700. So far, 112 Palestinians have been killed, more than 13,000 have been injured. Before we talk about media coverage of this, Shireen, can you talk about what life is like for the lives of the 1.9 million Palestinians living inside of the Gaza Strip?
Well, it's absolutely unique, and in all the terrible ways that you can call something unique, because Gaza really is and has been referred to as the largest open-air prison. We're talking about a stretch of land that's barely 25 miles long. There's the Egyptian checkpoint on one side and the Israeli checkpoint on the other. And Palestinians inside of Gaza, almost 2 million people, have no freedom of movement. They only have a certain amount of space to move within that territory, and then if they get to one end or the other, they are confronted with these checkpoints and so on that mean that they can't go out. Even by sea, there are restrictions so that they can only go out a certain amount before they're met by the Israeli Navy. So this is a blockade in all senses of the word, and the humanitarian situation inside of the Gaza Strip is, as you can imagine, completely dire, because Israel continues to strangle this population, to drip feed them just enough not to make them starve, but not enough that they have any sort of security, food security. The situation in terms of employment, there's no trade, of course, with the outside. They've completely isolated them. And Israel, as we've seen in the past few days alone, has successfully managed to dehumanize the Palestinians in Gaza to the point that when unarmed protesters are killed using tanks and drones, there is so little international reaction and outcry.
Shireen, we're getting some breaking news that the United Nations is launching a war crimes investigation into Israeli forces' shooting of protesters.
That's right. So this happened just an hour or so ago. In Geneva, the UN Human Rights Council, which is a subsidiary body of the General Assembly, voted to create what they call an independent commission of inquiry. And this would be a team of investigators that would look into international law violations by all sides. So it wouldn't just look into the conduct of the Israeli military, but would also tackle head-on these claims by Israel that Hamas are amassing on the border, telling people to go to the border and launching all sorts of projectiles and so on, and being aggressive. So this, you know, this panel would essentially go in and look at these claims and make determinations as to violations of international law. So on the surface of it, of course, it's a very welcome move. We're very happy to see that this vote was passed, even though it was quite concerning that we had Australia, for example, vote no. Australia and the U.S., not surprisingly for the U.S., were the only ones to vote against this resolution. But we did have a lot of abstentions, including by the United Kingdom and others. And that all goes to, you know, be quite worrying in terms of the possibility of implementing this resolution, because Israel made very clear after that vote that it doesn't see this COI, the Commission of Inquiry, as something that was legitimately formed, and therefore it's very unlikely they're going to comply. And if this team isn't allowed access by Israel into Gaza, because of course they control access into Gaza, then it won't be able really to do its work effectively.
Shireen Tadros is head of the UN office in New York for Amnesty International. She's a former award-winning journalist who was one of only two foreign journalists inside Gaza during the Israeli war on the Strip in 2008. Shireen, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
And we just had a little bit of time with Shireen, but we will definitely continue to talk about media coverage of this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you so much for joining us.